Hi, everybody. I'm Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, how's it going today? I'm grateful to be here today. There is nothing more humbling, at least in my life to this point, than standing behind this podium in front of you all. And the book talks about big shotism. The big shotism definitely disappears at this moment in time. I'm thrilled to be here. It's been an AA weekend for me. We spent the weekend in Richmond listening to some really fabulous speakers, and Billy was down there, and we had a chance to talk on a couple of occasions, and at some point he mentioned that I might be able to do this, or would I be able to do this, because Carl was going to speak and couldn't make it tonight, and I immediately said no as soon as he asked, had something I had to do, I was pretty sure, needed to check my calendar. And then the third speaker, or last night, yesterday's last speaker, got up there, and actually he got up there after the lights went out in the hotel, and there was no light in the conference room, in the ballroom, and I'm like, well, they probably just canceled this, he got up there with some candlelight or some lantern light and proceeded to speak, just tell his story. And it was the classic example of principles before personalities, because you could not see the guy's face. All you could see was an outline of this guy standing up there telling his story. And he was going at it as if he were, you know, spotlighted in full glory. But I thought after that, as that went on, I was pretty sure that I could probably come here and speak today. If, you know, this guy who had 30 plus years or whatever he had, some incredible amount of years of sobriety, was willing to stand up in the dark and do it for a bunch of drunks down in Richmond in the middle of a hurricane, I could probably come up here and do this. So I'm really, really grateful. I was riding down here and, talking to my higher power on the way and looking for, you know, a little strength, a little calm down. And he definitely filled my heart with gratitude and joy about the fact that it was another beautiful day in the neighborhood and I was alive and breathing. That's a place that I know I can always start, and where it goes from there, I have no idea. It has definitely been a week of powerlessness for sure. I was sitting in my office the other day when the hurricane hit, and it went and went and went, and I thought, uh-oh, if this doesn't stop soon, I think the building's going to blow up or something bad is going to happen. And it was clear that I could do absolutely nothing about it. So, then throw a hurricane on top of that and power going out and all that. So it's been a real interesting week, and I'm glad I'm standing here today. But we were driving back last night from Richmond on 64 in the midst of the storm, thinking, well, this is probably the best thing to do, but we're going to do it anyway, trying to kind of control the situation a little bit and hoping that there weren't going to be trees or branches or anything else flying across the road. But, that's always, I think, been my nature, is to want to control things. And I'm pretty sure that from the moment I was born an alcoholic, and that was in 1963 in Pembroke, Ontario, Canada, and I'm pretty sure I got a resentment with the fact that there was three words that I had to describe as far as where I was from. Everybody else could say Madison, Virginia. I had to say Pembroke, Ontario, Canada, and that right away that set me apart from everybody else. But that and a few other things, including the fact that, you know, my loving mom and dad. My dad, I always love telling my dad a little bit of my dad's story, especially the fact that he was born in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which I thought was the greatest name for any city on the planet, because there's no way I could possibly spell it, but it just sounded great coming out of my mouth. I'm pretty sure that I idolized and loved my mother and father from day one, whether I knew it exactly or not, because I know without a doubt, even though I don't remember much as a child, that they did everything that they could to take care of us and to give us whatever that they could. And in the early days, they didn't have a whole lot, so they gave us a lot of love. And I know that that was a fact. I certainly carried that forward, you know, as my dad, who was one of those guys who didn't really know what he was going to do with his life. His dad was a minister, and so he was the town terror, the kid who ran around ringing church bells at midnight, you know, that kind of thing. I think maybe there might be some genetics at play with that. I'm not sure, but, he didn't really know what he wanted to do with his life. So that took us on a journey over to England and a journey back to Colorado, where he ended up getting a job with United Airlines, and he became a pilot, and we ended up in the D.C. area, and they pretty much settled in this area and kind of slowly moved from, you know, managing an apartment to building their first, you know, home out in the country, you know, kind of a typical American dream family as far as, you know, how they wanted things to go. And, of course, so they had a son. You know, I'm the oldest of three. So not only did they now, was the American dream starting to come together, they now had a son, you know, a first child. And, you know, he was to be perfect, of course. And they started to lovingly impose that fact on me from day one. Well, you know, I'm not sure I remember the moment exactly. But I do know that, you know, they worked very hard to see that I followed, you know, what they wanted me to do and how they wanted me to do it and when they wanted me to do it and where they wanted me to do it and on and on and on. So we I think my dad was making up for lost time because he was such a terror as a child. He had a fairly strict regimen as far as what we were to do around the house and what we weren't to do around the house. And I think that he may have even been displaying some of that king baby, you know, I want what I want when I want it, and if I don't get it, I'm going to sit in the corner and pout kind of stuff, because he had a tendency to kind of go quiet when things didn't go his way, and I do remember that early on. But, you know, the best part about having loving parents is that they tell you, you know, they tell you that they love you, and they tell you, hey, we don't care what happens, Steve, just be happy. No matter what you do in life, just be happy. And you know, my mother was a big fan. She was a huge fan of mine. And unfortunately, when I got into school, you know, I started to tell everybody else just how big a fan my mother was of me. And that didn't go over very well. It didn't, I didn't understand why they didn't understand that I was as good a kid as my mom thought I was. I was just doing what came naturally. But that went over like a ton of bricks, as my mom would say. But I chummed up, you know, with the popular kids in the class, and you know, the popular kids in class seemed to do a lot of the same things. And one of those things that they did was pick on the unpopular kids in class. And I was right there in the middle of that, you know, picking on, you know, the goofy kid or the smart kid or the overly, you know, bookwormy type kid. And I just right in the middle of it, thinking this was great. And we, you know, cause we really didn't mean any of this. It wasn't really intended to be harmful. It was just, we were just joking around, and we were pretty sure that, you know, everybody else saw it the same way. They didn't see it the same way. Eventually, as life kind of went on for me, the tide turned on me as far as, you know, my peers were concerned. And you know, mom and dad were still hoping that, you know, everything was going to be perfect in my life. First child was going to be a perfect situation for them as well. My mom was an only child, so she had almost no experience seeing other kids in the family be raised. It was basically her. It was all about her. You know, at some point, you know, the kids at school started to turn on me, and I became one of those outcast kids. There was a moment of truth, or there was an occurrence where, you know, the wrong words were said and something was taken the wrong way. And basically it got, in a general way, I'll disclose in a general way, that things got bad for me suddenly. I went from being one of the in kids to being one of the very out kids. And life on a daily basis became a series of torture as far as I was concerned. And I know again that I was an alcoholic, because I was taking all of that to a total extreme. And it was, as far as I was concerned, there was merciless, you know, a merciless attack on me and you know, my character and all of the things that I stood for and that my family had told me I stood for. I didn't have a sense of humor about it at all. Let's just put it that way. And sought the refuge of, you know, folks who were kind of in the same boat, the misfit, the island of the misfits. You know, I went and started hanging out with guys who, you know, really probably didn't care about what anybody thought, and they were just doing their own thing anyway. And they kind of accepted me into their crew. And we were in alternate reality, and they were into alternate reality. They were into doing things like those role playing games, you know, where, you know, there were sorcerers and wizards and that type of thing. And I thought, this is awesome. You know, I can be everything I want to be with these guys in terms of making up, you know, that alternate reality, because life was not fun on the other side. You know, I quickly got resentments against, I didn't know they were resentments, but against the teachers, the school system, the principals, the superintendent of schools, you know, telephone companies because crank calls were being made on a daily basis to the house. You know, just endless stuff. And really, when I found this crew of alternate reality folks, the one thing that they also did was drink. And they did things like go out into the woods and have moon parties, you know, where, you know, Lowenbrau would be involved in these fancy, you know, beer bottles. And I think that was probably where I started to drink, you know, for the first time with these guys. And that was forbidden in my household. That was absolutely, drinking was not part of the formula, understandably. I mean, it was, you know, I wasn't of legal age. And so, you know, and I think that my dad had mentioned something about the fact that nothing ever good came from alcohol. Didn't really understand what that was all about. And at this point had also started to kind of develop a resentment against my parents because, man, this is relentless punishment. And I don't understand why I can't just do what I want to do. Every time they tell me not to do something, I do it and I get punished for it. It hurts and I don't like it. So, time is marching on. We're drinking on a daily basis, though, with these guys. You know, they found something called malt duck, which comes in a bottle about this tall, and it's pink. But it is cheap because I don't have a wallet even at this point in time, let alone really any money. And so, you know, you can get a big bottle of this stuff for about $1.50 or whatever it was at the time, and you would get messed up when you drank it. I mean, I would be in an alternate reality while playing alternate reality games. It was awesome. I mean, I didn't have to deal with any of the other stuff that was going on around us. And this was a daily occurrence. So I was getting to do everything that I wanted to do with these guys. I was feeling better about all this, and I was really digging in hard on a resentment with the fact that these kids were doing this to me. But now I didn't care because I was, you know, I knew that after school it was going to be time to drink and play, you know, play games with these other guys and gals. And, you know, but on the flip side, though, it was really important that I did not get caught by my mother and father. I really could not afford to get caught. So I worked really hard with things like, you know, gum and breath mints and all of that. And I'm fairly certain that that worked. I'm pretty sure that they never really knew that I was drinking for the most part. There did come a night, and I recently had an opportunity to make an amends or make a start on amends with my mother. And she told me something that was really cool about, you know, what had happened all those years ago. But on that first night, when it was pretty much confirmed that I had been drinking, I was driving my father's VW Rabbit, a little VW Rabbit. And I think that I had the thing revved at about 10,000 RPM, about a mile and a half down the road. And he heard it coming, and he had a funny feeling. He had a funny feeling that something was up, that perhaps my judgment might not be quite as good. But he taught me how to drive. I knew how to drive since I was 14. They set me on a hill with a pickup truck and a column shift and said, go. And so I learned how to drive. It was just that somehow this particular night, it was late. I was always running late because I was supposed to be in it, you know, X amount of time, and I was never able to call and say, I'm going to be late. It'll be okay, because I was just trying to avoid the fact that I was doing something I shouldn't be doing. But, so that night he got out of bed and came and confronted me and asked me if I had been drinking, and I absolutely said, absolutely not. You know, I know I haven't. And he just kind of looked at me and shook his head, and my mother told me the other day, she said, yeah, she was back in the bedroom crying her head out because she knew what was going on. And my father came back and said, your little angel has fallen. So I was like, wow, that's a great story. I mean, now I really kind of know what was going on. And that amends thing was really interesting with her. It was a really sweet, sweet thing to be able to do with her. And it's definitely one of the things that the program has given me. But, you know, the long and the short of it is, as far as those early days, I finally got up the nerve to have a real drink. It was because this malt duck was just garbage. And when you throw up in your bed after drinking malt duck that's pink and red, it's a very nasty sight when you wake up. You think you're actually bleeding to death. You look at all this stuff in your bed and you go, wow. And your mom comes in and she goes, oh, and she's crying, and you're cleaning up. We're trying to get this hustled away because she was one of those sponges that she would absorb everything that happened around the house so Dad wouldn't find out, because Dad's dad had died when he was 16, and my mom was pretty convinced that the same thing was going to happen to him. He wasn't going to make it for very long. So anything that she could do to avoid stress on him, she did. But there came that night when I decided that it was time to have a real drink, and I knew that my father had a liquor cabinet, that there was real drinks. I had seen commercials for scotch. I'm probably 16. I mean, I got a late start at it, but and I opened, went to the liquor cabinet, and it was night when they were gone, and my brothers were at the school doing a wrestling match or whatever it was, and I went and pulled out I think it was the Cutty Sark or whatever it was, very adult sounding, and I was excited, and I had a Cannonball Run cup that was about 60 ounces. And it had a bunch of ice in it, because that's what you did. That's what I thought you did, was, you put scotch on ice. And so I poured in some and didn't really seem to be much in there. So I just kept pouring until it was about three quarters of the way full. And I said, all right, let's have a drink. And I just, of course, I'm still nervous that someone's going to come home and I'm going to get caught. And so I drank that thing down as quickly as I could, put it away, and then, because I had to go pick up my brothers right away, and headed out to go pick them up from school. And then we were going to go down the street 10 or 15 miles to a pizza place and have some pizza. I got about halfway to the high school, and that Cutty Sark started to kick in. And I was starting to weave and dodge and not really sure where I was, and I didn't want them to know either. I was all about not having anybody know what was going on inside of me, outside of me, any part of me. I didn't want anybody to know. I just didn't. And I think that those humiliations, daily humiliations, had a lot to do with just building a wall. I just wanted to build a wall. I didn't want to have to deal with any of that anymore. But I definitely didn't want anybody to catch me having had this drink. But as we were careening at 90 miles an hour down the road with my two brothers in the back holding on for dear life, and I'm bouncing the car against the median strip, I knew that there was probably a problem. I didn't know any of that. They actually told me that years later, that that's what had happened. And I think that I blacked out that night for sure. I know that they told me later I helped the busboys bus tables at the pizza place. That was really, they were very impressed with that activity. And it was pretty clear, I guess, from that point on, that for me it was clear that I loved it. Now this was really kicking hard. The malt duck stuff was for wusses. This was a real drink, and I was gonna, I could black this blacking out thing was a different situation than I had experienced with the malt duck guys, because that was kind of a slow, long afternoon drinking session, where this was immediate results, and I liked those immediate results because I was all about killing pain at this point. I was all about killing the pain from the kids, in the school. I was all about killing pain with, living in this house that I didn't want to live in. And, they were making me do all of these things, and the punishment was they were too strict, and on and on and on. And at a certain point, corporal punishment stops and just guilt starts, I guess, is really what happens. And that's where I got to. And I say that gently, because they were the most loving parents you could have. There was never a case where a fist was balled and in anger, punch was thrown or anything like that. But boy, there was some heavy frustration going on. And now there were two of us, three of us to contend with. And so on any given day, at any given hour, someone was getting a whipping in our household. And but we had everything that we needed. It wasn't a case of, and they weren't drinkers. My mom and dad, they weren't drinkers. I told a story the other day that my dad had this leather case, this beautiful leather case that was about the height of a fifth, and it had the shakers and the little tools and all that sort of stuff that you could put. It was like a liquor picnic basket, and they would go to parties, they would go out to little social events, and they'd come back, and I used to see that, and I used to go, wow, that's what I want to do. That's classy, I want to be like that, as I had idolized my dad from the very beginning. At this point, I'm really fearing him more than I'm idolizing him because of what I'm doing, and the things that had happened to me at school were things that my dad was a pilot, like I said, so he was gone for four and home for four, so my mom was taking care of all the messes, and she was trying to help us through it, and she didn't want him to know anything about this, as far as what was going on with the kids at school. So, at some point, it was time to move on for me, and I had become, basically, by the time senior high hit, I had been a great student. They had really worked hard on me to be a good student. I was had a 4.0 all the way through 10th grade, 11th grade, and, eventually a B here or a B there. But, boy, I'll tell you, by the time I hit, 12th grade or whatever it was, I'd had enough. And I was like that character in the Peanuts who walks around in the dark cloud over his head, or you know, it was just, everything was a total depression for me. And life was really getting to the point of not really wanting to live it. But I knew that I had a way out because I'd been accepted at Virginia for early decision, and I knew I was going to go. All I had to do was pass high school. I had to get out of high school, but that was in doubt because I had stopped doing schoolwork. I had just said, to heck with this. I'm not interested. I've been accepted to this college, and I'm going to go and get out of there. And as soon as I could get out of there, I was out of there. And then life was going to begin because this was kind of a messed up situation. Now, again, I didn't really know the value of a dollar because we weren't spoiled by any means, but, you know, they had never wanted for anything that way. And we just, a bunch of know-it-all spoiled brats is really what it boils down to for me. You know, at this point, it was time to go to college. And that was sort of like the starting gate. The starting gun went off, and it was like the drag races where the pedal was put to the metal at that point. And everything, as if I hadn't already been doing everything I wanted to do, I said to myself, well, now I'm going to get to do everything that I really want to do in life, which had to do with one big party, because I knew college meant party. And, you know, I had for a long time thought that I was going to be a doctor. I guess, again, more alcoholism in early days before the first drink. I was not only going to be a doctor, I was going to be the world's most famous doctor, and was either going to find the cure to cancer or become the world's greatest heart surgeon somehow in around fourth or fifth grade. Who knows where that comes from, but, you know, was going to things like weekend seminars by Dr. Bakke, who had invented the artificial heart, this sort of thing. But at some point in time, that had all been washed away. And these cats who were, you know, kind of the misfits, were all in the theater department. They all were actors and technicians, mostly the technicians. And I thought, well, this is great because I can stand up on stage and everybody will clap for me and it will be awesome. And especially if I've had a couple drinks before I get up there, it'll really be awesome. But because I was a little nervous. I was a nervous guy. So I got to college thinking that's what I'm going to be. I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to go into the theater program at Virginia. And I got cast in a play. And I'm like, wow, here we go. This is great. The parties are awesome. Theater people love to party. There's a party every night, every day. This is awesome. I got up on stage that first time, and I was scared to death and couldn't remember my lines. And I said, wow, I have the two worst things you could possibly have if you want to be an actor, stage fright and lack of memory. So I ended up getting asked by the set design teacher if I wanted to be a set designer. So I ended up going into that and doing that for a while, which was great because now I could go spend 6 months in Georgia, or I could go spend a year in Boston, and I could jump around and find places. Main thing was I wasn't having to go back to where my family was, which meant where the other folks were, which were those memories, and I didn't have to deal with that. And I spent a lot of time, a long time, out on my own, which is all I ever wanted to do. I wanted to be out on my own doing what I wanted to do, and when I wanted to do it, how I wanted to do it. I remember getting so loaded up one night and sleeping through my morning classes. The whole balcony, the whole floor in my college dorm stood out there and watched my car get towed away because it was in a no parking zone, you know, that I had landed in, you know, one night. It was great. I mean, I heard someone the other day talking about how, you know, they really enjoyed their drinking. They really enjoyed, you know, the party. And I thought, wow, that's me. I really did enjoy it. For the longest time, I enjoyed it. I especially enjoyed when other outside issues were brought into the party, too. That was very cool. And because, you know, this was all validation for me. I was joining the club. You know, if you could drink more, if you could drink longer and faster, you were idolized. You were liked, you know, and I just wanted to be liked more than anything. And, you know, I knew none of these people. I had no idea who any of them really were. It was just, you know, one party after the next, after the next, after the next. I was always a hard worker. I always worked. When I did work, I worked hard. And that kind of kept me from totally failing out of college. But at some point, I realized I'd had enough, and I needed to take some time off. And so I took some time off and went up and taught at a college up in New York for a little while, and then came back and finished my senior year, and ended up in a theater job in Massachusetts. Massachusetts would be a place where I would spend a lot of time. And again, this is just one party after the next, night after night after night, hangover after hangover after hangover. But it was all about endurance. It was all about, you can do it. You know, it was all about, this is, you know, in my mind, this was what my life was supposed to be. This is what I had been waiting for. I had no clue, really, that I wasn't achieving, I wasn't attaining, I wasn't having, I wasn't, you know, all of those things that I guess other people were doing. And frankly, I was doing what I love to do. I love the set design thing. I love that creative process. I love getting in with a group of individuals, sitting down, tearing apart a script, and coming up with, you know, a visual presentation that helped to communicate the message of a play. You know, I ended up working with a great group of people who were had a children's theater, and they had all kinds of good funding from a bank, and we just did some spectacular productions, and kids came by the thousands, and to see the smiles on their faces and to see them get into it was really, really rewarding. And you know, so there was something going on up here, you know, through some of that. But, you know, for the most part, I was always able to fall back on the party, and always wanted to fall back on the party, because now I had spent a fair amount of time, you know, drinking in bars. Bars was where I'd like to be, because there were people there. And I don't know if I ever consciously thought about it, but I think that I just didn't really want to sit at home by myself. I really had some problem somehow with wanting to be alone. And I knew that if I went to a bar, that there would be people there. And if I had six or seven drinks before I went to the bar, I'd be immediately comfortable when I walked into the bar. And that by the time, you know, I left out of there, you know, I would have had a lot of fun. And, you know, that worked for a little while. But, man, I also thought that I was going to meet the next Mr. Steve or Mrs. Steve there. And, you know, that just never seemed to really happen. I'd be in and out of good relationships with good women that I would completely tank. That happened a lot, too, it seemed. And I could never be faithful to one person. Had real issues with that as far as keeping together, you know, any kind of relationship. And it was okay because that's the way I wanted it anyway. You know, I really didn't want to have this person tying me down and dragging me down, because I was all about happiness. That's what they had said to me. He says, no matter what, Steve, just be happy. And I figured, okay, I've got this. I'm pretty much happy. I guess this is pretty much it. And I don't know, at some point, you know, that endless cycle of going to the bar, looking for someone, not finding anybody, going home and being by yourself just got to me. And I just said, I just can't take this anymore. And I would be wandering around drunk out in the, you know, out in the where, who knows where, and just feeling so terribly sorry for myself and just feeling so terribly alone. And I remember trying to cut my arm off at one point, thinking this is the end of it, you know. And didn't have the guts to really do anything. It was really more, I think, well, looking back on it, just an attempt to get somebody's attention. At least that's what they said. I don't really know what it was. It was desperation, is what it was. It's probably my first encounter with real desperation. And I really didn't want to kill myself. I really didn't. But I really didn't want to hang around either. I just had enough of this. This wasn't working out the way I had envisioned it to be. It was going to be a lot rosier than this, because I was going to get to party and do all that, and I was going to have the perfect relationship, and I was going to have all this. I was going to get to have my cake and eat it too, because that's what happiness was, having everything. Because, you know, we all had everything, right? I didn't understand that there were trials and tribulations, that there were ups and downs. I wanted to be up all the time. Because I really got affected in a negative way by that whole school thing. And even that, though, was starting to fade. I just wanted to keep the party going. You know, and eventually I made a really smart business move, and the theater that I was working with went under because the economy in about 89, 90 kind of went in the toilet. That was one of the first times that I remember our economy going down. And so I decided to strike out on my own and start my own company. And that was really convenient, because I could kind of work when I wanted to, not work when I wanted to. And all I had to do is get together enough money to be able to keep going out and impressing my friends, because I really didn't want you to know that I was didn't have a whole lot of money, was kind of an idealist, had things that I liked to do. I was really more interested in telling you stories about where I had been and who I was. You know, if I could convince you that I was a member of a rock band, that would be ideal, especially if you would believe me, you know, because it might get me somewhere with you. You know, I just remember that was another part of the whole deal. You know, a couple drinks down the road, I could start talking a bunch of bull about who I was, and you might believe it. And if you didn't believe it, I was probably just going to walk away and move on to the next. But it was, I guess it was all done with a good heart. I always thought I had a good heart with it all. You know, I really wasn't, like picking on the kids, you know, early on. It wasn't something I was doing intentionally to hurt you. I just wanted to do the things that would ensure that you would like me, that, you know, and if I had to tell you that I was, you know, the Prince of Saudi Arabia and you would believe me, then that's what I would do. Because I sure didn't want you to find out how desperately lonely and how bad I felt on the inside, because I still did feel bad. And nothing was happening. Nothing was really working out. And once I got to that, you know, self-employed status, and I've heard others talk about that status, and I really connect with their stories when they talk about that, you know, it opened up a whole new horizon for me, because now all I really had to do was put together enough cash from time to time to keep, you know, the party rolling. I finally did get a girlfriend, and she liked drinking and partying and entertaining at the little apartment that I was able to rent, and there were always 30 or 40 people over at the house every night, and a lot of outside issues, and a lot of drinking. And you know, that went on for a good couple of years, and eventually something happened where I wasn't really so much interested in having a relationship with anybody. I was more interested in keeping the flow of drugs and alcohol into my system. I think that's, you know, and I started to sacrifice things like time with loved ones, like family get-togethers. When I would come home from Massachusetts, I was living in Massachusetts, to be with my family, it was a typical, really nice, you know, perfect Christmas dinner, say, for example. And as soon as we could get out of the house, my brothers and I were off to the bar, where we would be tearing up vehicles, you know, people's lives and bar tabs. And it was brutal. I mean, it was a brutal party schedule to keep up with. I mean, it was we really ran very hard. But that was it. That was the essence of our relationship. Get to the bar and drink and tolerate being, you know, at home for as little as possible, little time as possible. But so I didn't really get to know my brothers, and I didn't get to know things like that they were kind of missing me as a brother, because, again, I left home when I was 18, and I had no intention of ever coming back. I never wanted to see the town that I grew up in. It would be happy if I just got to, you know, had to see, you know, family on holiday times once or twice a year was great, because I was doing fine on my own, thank you very much. And certainly, you know, family had no value to me, really. Or let's just say at this point I had lost all value for my family. So, you know, it was very dysfunctional when it comes to forming a relationship with your family, and I didn't realize that until I got into this program and figured out that I had to go try to talk to them about what was going on, or you know, had to try to connect with them, and you know, that whole amends thing. But eventually, you know, I just kept isolating more and more and more, and money was becoming harder and harder to keep. Money was important to me because it let me do what I wanted to do when the work was done. You know, I like to have an office. I had a little office up there, and that was important because I, you know, I had a company. I was somebody. You know, I had a business. Yeah, very important. You know, marketing and sales, and you know, all that sort of thing. And that was always a good rap when it came to trying to describe who I was. But it was getting harder and harder to, for some reason, to put these jobs together, get these jobs done, and you know, we'd do things like websites or logos or, you know, your marketing collateral and that kind of thing. It was getting harder and harder to get these jobs done and get this money so I could get out and get drunk again, and you know, get out and go. They used to refer to the local bar as Steve's second office. That was kind of like, is he in his home office or is he in his satellite office? And the bar was, you know, a place where I could conduct business, of course, because there was always someone to talk to and the juices were always flowing, you know, when it came to figuring out your problems and what we could do to help you. And here's my business card. And isn't this wonderful? And, you know, it was getting harder and harder to do that. I don't know what it was, but for some reason, this was taking a toll on me. And this was a surprise because by now I'd had fantasies about living forever. You know, I really figured that I was probably going to be the one. you know, that was going to hang around, and you know that you know, nothing could really harm me. It was that 10-foot tall and bulletproof, you know, concept, you know, times 100, because I was a total egomaniac at this point, and I kind of knew that, and I also kind of knew that the way I was living my life and the way I was feeling, and it was uncomfortable. It was starting to get uncomfortable. And I don't mean it was hangover to hangover. There's always the hair of the dog for that. But it was getting uncomfortable to the point where I just wasn't pulling it off. It wasn't so easy anymore. And not that it necessarily ever was that easy, but it was really getting uncomfortable at this point. At some point, it all just washed over me. It all just totally overwhelmed me. I got introduced to some things that I really, outside issues that I really should not, and that is definitely part of my story. And, you know, I say that, and I heard someone say this at this meeting one night, which was, I don't mean to say that because that's a requirement for being an alcoholic. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a problem with alcohol. When I drink, I can't stop drinking, and that was always part of this formula. But these other outside issues were fed once I started to drink. Once I started to drink, I was willing to go out and do anything, anything that I could do to elevate that high, because suddenly the alcohol high wasn't enough. I needed rocket fuel. I needed to get that nitrous kick, you know, in the engine to really keep it going, or just to make me feel better, because I could never quite get back to that warm feeling of that Cannonball Run glass with the Cutty Sark. I mean, that was awesome. You know, I mean, it was just that feeling like they all talk about, you know, that just washes over you and the warmth and everything's going to be okay kind of thing. Well, these outside issues and this constant party just started to really blow me away. And I got evicted from the apartment that I was living in because I didn't pay my rent. And I got taken to housing court, and I got stood up in front of the judge, and she said, "You're going to have to leave your house." And I thought, okay, I know where I can stay. It's no big deal. So I ended up camping on, and I had let other people stay at my house. So I figured, you know, they who were in a similar circumstance. So I kind of thought that this was, you know, their turn to help me out. And it was kind of just, you know, one of those things. And it didn't feel very good, though. I have to admit that standing up in front of that judge was a tough pill to swallow. I was just hoping I wasn't going to go to jail. I mean, I had definitely been caught, but I was 500 miles away from home. So as long as I could keep this contained in the town and no one knew about it, it was going to be okay, and I was going to get through it, because every day I could wake up and there was hope. You know, there was always hope that today was going to be better, and that if I could just get around that next corner and put together, you know, another stack of cash, that, you know, things were going to turn out just the way I wanted them to. And I always kind of had that little bit of hope in the back of my mind. But, you know, It was September 11th coming up. I can remember almost 10 years ago now, September 11th. They always say, "Well, where were you on September 11th?" And I know where I was. I was laying in front of the TV on the floor, drunk and high, going, you know, "I'm going to be evicted tomorrow." That's about where we were, you know, with my timeline. And so I ended up spending, you know, 6 months or so on a guy's sofa, and We were down and out at this point. We were starting to become down and outers. We didn't have any money between the two of us. It was one of those cases where if one guy got money, we could all go out and do what we wanted to do. And, you know, we had a good stock of ramen noodles in the house, which were, you know, $25 a packet. And that meant we would be able to eat, so we'd be fine there. But we kind of looked at each other from time to time and said, you know, this is tough. But, eventually, I packed up all the stuff that I had in my car and, under the darkness of night, left Massachusetts and said, "If I don't leave, I'm going to die or I'm going to be killed." I just had that feeling. It was one of those moments of a little mini turning point before the actual turning point. And came home and said to my mother and father, I said, I'm busted, man. I am an alcoholic. I'm an addict, and I need help." And my dad kind of knew this because for years they've been sending money up to Steve when Steve needed help, or at some point they kind of thought, "He still needs help. Maybe we ought to write the electric company's name on the check when we send it up there so that actually the electric bill gets paid," that kind of thing. And, you know, so they kind of knew, and my dad had kind of set up a rehab situation up in Winchester, and everyone was feeling good. It was positive. It was like, oh, and I felt such a relief off my shoulders that this was finally going to be a situation where I could get some help. And it was about November time, and at some point somebody said, "Well, Steve, you can't go to rehab now. You'll be in there over Christmas." I said, "Oh, that's right. Okay, I'll go after New Year's. You know, we'll go after New Year's." And you know, they said, "Oh, you will, right?" He says, "Yeah, that's right. Okay, so dinner, you know, Christmas dinner's next week or whatever." So, 10 years later, I finally went to my first AA meeting, and that's after living in town here now, only 20 miles or 30, 40, 40 miles away from my mom and dad, living with my brother with no job, no real desire to contribute to a household, and lying about what I was doing. I had started all over. At first it was good. I was keeping my nose clean. I was, you know, doing what they were doing. So it was okay. You know, as long as I didn't jump over to the dark side, as it were, it was going to be okay. But my brother would ask me from time to time, "Are you sure you're not doing such and such?" And I'd say, "Oh, absolutely not." You know, I was doing it the whole time, and I thought I was hiding it just like I had thought I'd been hiding it for years and years. And there was no attempt to quit drinking, because drinking wasn't the problem. It was the other stuff that was really the problem. But very quickly, you know, stories of being held up at gunpoint downtown in Culpeper got back to my dad, and, you know, it was getting really, really dicey. You know, I was hanging out with some people now, which at a whole new level of low, which was, you know, folks that, you know, had police looking for them. You know, people were coming in and out of my house on a daily basis and a nightly basis as if it was their house, and I was letting them do it. You know, I was giving them my car in exchange for things, you know, when I had no money. You know, I had gotten a job, and you know, I was putting $500 a month towards the place that my brother was letting me live. And they said, "At the end of the year, we'll give you all the money back so you can get back on your feet." That's how willing they were to kind of seed me, you know, get me going. And, you know, I couldn't wait to get that money and do things with it, do all kinds of things with it. And, you know, I ended up getting a job and in town here after 4 or 5 years of sponging off my brother, you know, taking his checkbook and writing checks whenever I wanted them, you know, those kinds of things. You know, not feeling so good about this, because now this was really starting to hurt, you know. And eventually sitting in my apartment that night, that one last night, with no heat, no electricity, no food, no money, no water, no gas, no nothing, trying to stay warm with blankets, only thankful for the fact that I had a paycheck that paid the rent prior to me getting a hold of my paycheck, I knew that something had to change. I looked at myself and I thought, they're going to find me dead on the floor here in this mess, and it's going to be ugly, and I'm going to be really sad, and I'm not going to know it, you know, and they're going to be really sad. And I felt really bad about that. And I felt like, you know, here I was at 45 now, and 30 years had gone by, and I couldn't really tell you much of what happened over 30 years. I really couldn't. It was a big party blur. It was a big blur. And I said to my brother at one point, "I don't want to go through another 10 years and look back and not see what happened in that 10 years. And it's going to happen. It's going to happen." And a friend of mine had said, "I'll take you to a meeting." You know, a party buddy had said, "I'll take you to a meeting when you want to go." And I said, "Well, how will I know when it's time to go?" And he goes, "Oh, you'll know." And he was right, because at some point, the pain got to the point where I said, "Please take me. Please, I don't care. I don't know what it is, really. I thought I did, because I think I know everything." And I went. And the moment I walked in to that door up on 522, the little church there, and sat down at a table and said, "My name is Steve, and I'm an alcoholic," I felt like the weight of the world had been taken off my shoulders. It was like, I don't know why I feel good, but I feel good about this. I even felt good on the ride over to the meeting. I thought, this is something different, I guess, is what it was. I didn't know if I was going to drink or not drink or what it was going to be. I just knew I couldn't keep doing what I was doing. Because, you know, the people that I had been with, one of the guys got killed that night. And it was like, that's like, you know, whizzing right by my head. I'm next. I knew that I was on the ninth live. I just didn't know if it was the beginning of that ninth live or the end of that ninth live. I just knew that it was the jig was up is what I thought about it. And my sponsor says that was a gift of desperation that I got. That's what he taught me. And he said, you know, we get that gift of desperation where we're willing to do anything to change, or we're willing to do anything to not feel this way anymore. And boy, was he right. And you know, the only requirement they said was that you just don't drink. You know, if you, the only requirement for membership was a desire not to drink. So I didn't have to be smart. I didn't have to be entertaining. I didn't have to be all those things I had tried to be for all those years. All I had to do was sit down and try to scrape together a dollar, because they would take a dollar, you know, each day in the basket. And I just had no idea what this was all about. I just knew that I did not want to be identified. Now, you know, as soon as, you know, that distance between total desperation and I'm starting to get my feet under me now can be very quick. It can be, you know, I can suddenly think, okay, now I'm doing something for myself. This is good. And, you know, I start overthinking and I start kind of thinking about, okay, I see how this works. Yeah, I think I got this. You know, I'm thinking, maybe another meeting or two will be enough, and that'll be, you know, I'll be on my way. And they told me, no, that's not true. Just keep coming back. And they would kind of laugh a little bit when they said that. But they would say it in a way that was kind, and they would say it in a way that was friendly, and they wouldn't make fun of me. And I thought, gosh, these guys aren't making fun of me. That's really cool, because my impression was that for most of my life, people had made fun of me for some reason, or at least that's what I thought. This was a group of bunch of different ages and bunch of different looks, and you know, and the thing that was cool about it was they weren't holding on to the table for dear life, trying to make it through the next minute. They were laughing and they were joking and they were having fun, and they told me that there were these steps and there was this book, and that I should just do everything I could do to get into this, to jump head first into this, and you know, that I should go to any length to stay sober. And I thought, man, this is perfect. Because I always thought that going to the military would have been the best thing for me, you know, a long, long time ago. This sounds like this is like this AA boot camp that's going to really straighten things out for me. And, you know, they were so patient. Everyone was so patient. They told me I should get a sponsor. And I found a guy who was much bigger than me and looked much meaner than me. And I thought, you know, this is going to be important because I'm going to need a bodyguard. There's going to be some security issues that might come up. And I didn't know that he was actually going to teach me something. No one was going to teach me anything. I mean, I just feel terrible and I'm willing to do this. But boy, I got to say that, you know, that was the biggest, and that has been the biggest and best surprise of all about this wonderful program, is that it teaches me something every day, and it teaches me something when I least expect it. It teaches me something when I'm not looking for it. It teaches me something when I'm looking over there. It's over there. And you know, he used to say that, you know, he never saw any of it coming. I thought, now I kind of start to get a little sense of what that means. You know, just when you think you got it, you don't got it, and you find out in the most gentle way that you could find out. You don't have to, you know, fall down and bust your head open to learn these lessons. And you get to go to things like the convention that we went to on this weekend and listen to these guys who are, you know, a million years old, who've been doing this for a long time, and they're still coming back, and they're still talking about, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And they do it because, you know, it helps people. And that was the last thing on my list when I came to my first meeting, was helping people. I wanted to be helped. I desperately needed help. You know, but of course, I thought right away that I need to start helping people, and somehow, you know, that's going to be a part of it, until someone came up and said, sponsor him. And I said, no, I'm not sponsoring him. No way. I don't want to do that. I want to choose how I help people, you know. I want to choose how I, you know, dole out my help. And they said these 12 steps at the end of them that would result in a spiritual awakening. And I thought, man, that's like 10 million miles down the road, that with those words, spiritual awakening. And that's not really... you know, I had a God of my understanding. I had a God. I didn't understand him. And I knew that I had turned my back on him for a lot of years. What I didn't expect was, I didn't expect that AA would help me plug into that God of my understanding, or that God that I had or thought I had, and help me to understand him. And that was that important, you know, and working those first three steps for me was a new life was already starting to emerge. And, you know, they talked about that spiritual awakening. And after a little bit of time, my sobriety date is March 17th, 2009. Of course, being an egomaniac, I thought that St. Patrick's Day would be a great day for a guy with a little bit of Irish blood to have his sobriety date. But it really is the day that I the first day that I didn't have a drink. And the last drink I had, I can still see, it was this little, you know, glass of cheap wine in the candlelight. It was like, you know, this, it wasn't a rip-roaring drunk. It didn't need to be. I couldn't take it anymore. But the spiritual awakening, you know, was something that was out there, and that I kept thinking, okay, try to work my steps with the sponsor. I didn't want to, but he would tell me do it, and I would get all irritable, discontent, and messed up, and he'd say, it's time to work a step, and I'd say, okay, I guess you're right, and, you know, he was just so patient with me. Everyone was just so patient with me when I was being kind of a jerk about it all, you know, because I knew how to do this now. I had gotten, you know, a couple of months underneath me, and, you know, it was working. It was really working. And you know, I pretty much, I thought, well, maybe I could reform things and change things around a little bit so that, you know, we could speed up the process and this wouldn't necessarily be a lifelong event. You know, all I know is that as time went on, I actually did. Things started to happen just like you all said they would happen, just like my sponsor said, just like you all said it would happen. Every day you seem to say the same thing over and over again. I remember saying early on, I'm like, why does he keep repeating himself? He keeps saying the same. This is an amazing program. Yeah, I know it's an amazing program, but he would say it every day. It's an amazing program. And then after a while, I started saying it's an amazing program because I started to see exactly what he was saying, that it was working in my life because I was willing to go to any length. And I just kept saying that, and he kept reminding me of that too. It's like, you remember you were willing to go to any length, and they shipped me off to spiritual retreats, and I was willing to go, and I was willing to try to do some service. And then eventually at some point, I that fear, it was really that self-centered fear that the book talks about and that we all wrestle with, that was certainly at the heart of every character defect or every resentment or every, you know, part of that fourth and fifth step that I did. That fear started to melt away just enough where I would say, okay, I'll try to sponsor somebody when they finally came and asked, or someone came up and asked me. And then when I did, four people asked me in the same week, I'm like, oh no, what's going on? I can't, you know, but that spiritual awakening, you know, seemed to be getting closer, and I really didn't quite understand it. But I don't know. I was expecting, you know, that burning bush, that gigantic lightning bolt, that moment of truth where the heavens open and the light comes down and goes, and, you know, and you suddenly are spiritually awake. And, you know, what I kind of discovered, or what I have been fortunate to try to learn a little bit about, is that as time goes by, if you keep coming back, things will change in spite of me. And that's what happened. And that's what still happens up to today. And, you know, that spiritual awakening, which I thought was going to be some sort of possibly God-related thing, but I didn't really know, has really turned into a willingness to help others. And it has really turned into a change from the guy who came in the first day, busted up, who didn't want anything to do with you and your ideas and helping anybody else, to someone who's at the very least willing to say, yeah, I'll try. Because I, you know, this past week has been one heck of a week, and it's been one heck of a learning week. And fortunately, it helped me discover and understand that I really do need you guys. And as much as I'd like to be able to pack it up and walk away and go on and live that glorious life that I think I can live, I'm actually living it with you. And it's amazing. It really is. Just like my sponsor said, it's an amazing program and it's an amazing life. And I couldn't be more happy. I'm so much more relaxed now. It's so nice to talk, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. And, you know, I marvel at those guys who can get up there and they talk about their 35 plus years of experience and how clear their message is. And I like the opportunity of being able to stand up in front of a group and come face to face with the fears that I have in my life, because I have a lot of them still, and I bring them with me everywhere I go, it seems. But every time we try to do something that stretches us a little bit, maybe those fears go away a little bit. And hopefully I've said something that you all connect with. And my name is Steve. I am an alcoholic. Thanks for letting me share.